Okay, babe, we're going on a sex strike because... Okay, we're going on a sex strike because if we don't go on a sex strike, then you won't learn your lesson. If we go on a sex strike, then you're gonna be like, I'm horny and mad. And then you're gonna finally read about abortion laws in Georgia. If I'm getting any sort of physical pleasure, it just means that women are losing. You know what I mean? What happens with queer women? That's not really what we're talking about. Well, what does this mean about rape victims? Yeah, that's not really what we're talking about. You're gonna get so horny that you explode and basically run to Georgia and change all the laws. Do you know what I mean? And that's just as important to me.
That was a funny Twitter character named Ava Victor, very good at a Twitter follow, by the way, parodying an instantly infamous tweet Friday from Alyssa Milano, in which the Who's the Boss activist asserted that, quote, our reproductive rights are being erased, and until women have legal control over our own bodies, we just cannot risk pregnancy. Join me by not having sex until we get bodily autonomy back. This hashtag sex strike, which, to be clear, is not a thing that's actually happening in the world, as far as I can tell, was a response to a series of state laws, most recently in Georgia, imposing severe restriction on abortion, in Georgia's case, outlawing the procedure if a fetal heartbeat can be detected. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable edition of The Reason Podcast. I'm Matt Welch, joined by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy day four of the non-existent sex strike, my colleagues.
Hi, Matt.
Cut thump.
Matt.
Cut thump. Cut thump.
Was that you being a fetal heartbeat?
That was just my heartbeat.
They're real fast, actually. That's more like thump, 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 thump.
I don't know why we had to go straight into that. But Catherine, okay, so you're the lady, and you're also a journalist. I find it always kind of morbidly fascinating how whenever one of these, you know, hot button political culture war issues come up, even when there's written text, even when there's a thing with words, the description of what that thing is varies so incredibly wildly in the midst of everyone screaming at each other. So you've actually looked at the law in Georgia. Are women going to jail for 30 years? And or does this really change almost nothing? Pierce through it all.
So, yeah, the first thing to say is that the headlines, which imply that in particular, I think the most egregious version of these is the ones that imply that women who miscarry face life in prison, which was the stuff of actual headlines this weekend. That's wrong. That's very, 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 very likely to be wrong. I think the thing to understand about the Georgia bill, as well as the Alabama bill, which did not pass, is that these bills are designed to do something very specific, and it is to generate the conditions for the Supreme Court to revisit Roe v. Wade. So, you know, even though, of course, they will have impacts on actual women in the world, it's important that, like, when you're trying to understand what's going on in these bills, it's not actually really about individual behavior. It's about a very arcane legal process whereby we need lower courts to disagree so that the Supreme Court has something to rule on to sort out that disagreement. So that's the baseline first. Just like, to understand all these bills, you have to understand what they are for, and it is to generate the conditions for a Roe v. Wade challenge and revisiting by the Supreme Court. But then I think the other piece to talk about is, like, okay, what is going to happen to actual women in the meantime? One thing to note here is that the bill doesn't kick in Georgia until 2020. So right now, nothing has changed. Everyone should calm down. Everyone should calm down a little bit. It's a very important issue, and so it's understandable that people feel strongly. At the same time, having sex with someone that generates a pregnancy right now, even in Georgia, nothing different will happen than what was the case previously.
But there's no question that, I mean, this is part of a long-term concerted effort to restrict abortion rights.
Right.
That's the headline, right? That there is a concerted effort throughout many multiple states to end, the protections granted under Roe v. Wade and then a series of other you know, other Supreme Court rulings.
Sure, but that's
I think it's
not
worth taking seriously. And there's a case in Ohio where an 11-year-old girl who was raped and is now pregnant may not be able to get an abortion. It's kind of here and now. And in Texas, there was a law that was ultimately overturned, but restricted the ways in which abortion providers could provide their services.
Nick, you've made the perhaps counterintuitive to some claim when writing about this issue in the past that there's actually kind of a rough consensus in America, a legal cultural consensus over an issue which otherwise is so polarized and sort of defines the two opposing political blocks. We have, throughout the course of talking on Mondays here, pointed out that the kind of center in American politics is one of the most despised places to be at a time of heightened polarization. So do you think that that consensus will hold, and can you define it a little bit?
Well, you know, the broad consensus is simply that, you know, the closer a pregnancy is to its beginning, or a woman being pregnant, the more support there is for her being able to have an abortion without having to explain anything to anybody or anything like that. And the longer a pregnancy continues, the less so, you know, in legally we don't use trimesters anymore, but it's like if you're 8 months into a pregnancy, many more people are uncomfortable with abortion then, as opposed to if you're at 8 weeks. And that has basically been the case since Roe v. Wade. And there's like been consistent national polling on that. And the closer, the further you move, the more people get mixed, to a point where most people are in favor of abortion early on in what would have been the first trimester. Most people are against it in the third trimester. And at the same time, over, you know, the past 40 years, you know, the number of abortions have been going down substantially. And that's partly or almost certainly due to improvements in birth control technology and use of birth control and things like that.
It's also due to the teenagers having not enough sex.
Right. Because we switched from the era where teenagers were having too much sex directly to the era where teenagers were having not enough sex.
There was like a day in like August 17th of like 2015.
Where teenagers were having exactly the right amount of sex.
Exactly the right amount. But then the chart just kept going down. And
I mean, I love me some
enough.
I love me some Lisa Strada, right? Like I am always up for like political tactics motivated by classical literature. So the sex strike amuses and charms me. At the same time, I think you know, probably everyone's individual personal policy should be don't have sex with people who you don't have a consensus with about what you will do if that sex results in a pregnancy. Like, that's a good personal policy to have. It's not 100% clear to me, as that comedy routine that we played at the top of the show demonstrates, what exactly the causal mechanism is whereby not having sex with some random dude in some random state right now generates political change in Georgia.
Peter, we're in an era where Congress doesn't actually do a whole hell of a lot except, you know, figure out a new way to spend more money on the military and a few other kind of rubber stampy type of activities. Is this kind of the logical end of that abdication of doing stuff, or the sort of like a useful stalemate in Congress that you end up with issue that really motivates people on either side? Guns comes to mind as well, that what you do to try to impact federal policy, national policy, is by having states essentially taunt the Supreme Court into setting whatever the new parameters are for it.
Well, that's certainly a strategy for making a national change on certain types of issues. But in this case, the way that Roe v. Wade works, it's actually not easy for Congress to step in, even if Congress had the will to and wanted to, which certainly in a divided Congress like we have right now, there's no consensus legislation between, you know, the Nancy Pelosi's House Democrats and Senate Republicans. That doesn't exist. So there's no chance that Congress would do anything, even if they could. But the way, you know, this is an argument that is true up to a point that pro-lifers have made for a while, which is that Roe v. Wade really does not allow for kind of what they would describe as reasonable limits on abortion. And so, and it doesn't allow for states to make their own policies and for, in a lot of ways, and for variations to exist. And so that is what this is about. And you even see this in some of these laws, as Catherine said, you know, these are intentionally designed. What's amazing is that legislators are actually saying that these are intentionally designed to trigger Supreme Court review. And so, like, you've got the sponsor of this bill in Alabama says, yes, it's unconstitutional. Yes, it's unconstitutional. That is a direct quote. All our pro-life bills are unconstitutional right now. That's the goal. And so the entire idea is to get the Supreme Court, the makeup of which has changed in the last year, to get the Supreme Court to look at the issue again, in hopes, the pro-life side hopes that they will allow for state variation. And what that would do is end up with a situation in which a number of states, it's very difficult, if not nearly impossible, to get an abortion.
The one thing that I love about that quote also is the deep conflation of the idea of something being constitutional with something being allowed as elaborated by the court at the moment, right? Like, what he actually means is not that he thinks it's unconstitutional. He thinks the Constitution permits these laws. He means the court, as of right now, has ruled this thing unconstitutional, and we are hoping to change that.
And there is a long-standing argument amongst legal scholars, even folks, even in some cases, folks who are basically pro-choice, about whether Roe v. Wade is good precedent and was a good decision, and whether the idea that, you know, they found a right to privacy in the emanations and penumbras of the Constitution, basically they sort of squinted and said, well, it's not there, but it's there, whether that is a good way to read the Constitution.
And it absolutely did set up the situation of live by the court, die by the court, right? And so that's what everyone is now responding to, those incentives. And what you get are these very, these laws, the law in Georgia does not reflect the underlying agreement on the part of a majority or even probably a significant plurality of Georgia citizens. What it reflects is the most effective stance from which to take up a court case.
There's a bloodlessness that's going on in this conversation that I find frustrating, because the real question is does a woman have a right to control her body, including getting an abortion? And if so, is that a right that should be guaranteed by the federal government, like speech or arms or whatever? And I think that's worth the debate worth having. Is a fetus, is an 8-week-old fetus, is a 16-week-old fetus, is a 9-month-old fetus a person that is guaranteed certain rights, including life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or not? And I think that's, you know, the idea that the only reason why pro-life people are upset is because Roe versus Wade doesn't allow state-by-state variation is wrong, because people who are pro-life are saying, you know, everywhere and always, abortion is always wrong. They will work to illegalize abortion in every place that they find it.
I'll just read you a headline from a piece by Ramesh Panuru, who no one would accuse of being kind of squishy on this issue. Pro-lifers have momentum, but they need to move gradually. Demanding too much too soon would cause a backlash. He wrote a piece for Bloomberg in April of this year. And this is a guy who wrote a book titled The Party of Death about Democrats and abortion policy. So again, not someone who anyone would accuse of being kind of a mushy middle ground person who doesn't have strong views on this issue. And he is saying, well, look, the goal right now is, yes, the ultimate goal is to, yeah, to reduce and eliminate
Where
all
do
abortion.
Libertarians
but like,
stand
but he
that,
is arguing. Though. He is arguing for a much more moderate and incrementalist policy.
That's a strategy, but the goal is to ban abortion. And again, I'm not, you know, like, just, we should be able to admit that, and also admit that there's a range of positions among libertarians and stuff like that. But to be talking about tactics and things like that, I think we should, you know, it's worth kind of, you know, coming to some articulation of, like, what's the basic principle here? If we were talking about speech, nobody would be like, oh, well, you know what? States actually should be given, you know, they should be laboratories of democracy. And maybe some states won't even guarantee free speech or anything like that. I mean, where are we on this issue? I mean, I think for all of the discussion about how Roe versus Wade is bad because judicial activism enforced a national standard, like in all sorts of other circumstances, we're totally okay with that if it furthers the liberty interests. And I think Roe versus Wade does. It is also, and, you know, and this goes to, you know, the inclusion of Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court really makes people, conservatives or anti-abortion people, think that they have the upper hand now, that they've got a 5-4 court that they can go. The actual precedents in his legal history, it's not clear that that's true. But, you know, there is just this basic question. Is it a good idea? Like, does a woman have a right to have an abortion in any state in the country or not? I mean, I think she does. And I think that that's the starting point of all of these conversations, because the other thing that is amazing in all of the laws that are done to restrict or hobble abortion rights, they are cases where conservative lawmakers who typically hate regulation of small businesses or the government getting involved in the weeds of discussion, like, you know, these laws will talk about very specific medical procedures. They'll dictate the width of hallways in abortion clinics and things like that in a way that conservatives normally would go insane if big government was reaching into small businesses. And on the flip side, you have abortion, proponents who suddenly say, you know what, like, abortion facilities shouldn't be regulated at all, even as they want to regulate all sorts of stuff. There's a mushy kind of weirdness going on with this. And I think it's good to start with first principles of saying, like, well, should do women have the right to have an abortion? I think so.
I mean,
just as a factual case, I mean, a lot of the fighting has been over between what, like 20 and 22 weeks and these kind of things. But then also, as Nick was saying, let's make access to actual clinics a lot more difficult in a huge state like Texas. And pretty consistently, the Supreme Court has ruled that, no, you're doing this to make it harder. That's against the rules as we see it now, which is interesting. I would point out that the Kentucky passed a pretty similar 6-week ban on abortion, and that was ruled unconstitutional, in contravention of Roe v. Wade on Friday by a federal judge. So, sorry, Catherine, you were jumping in there.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think using rights language to underpin the question is where I would begin, and I would say I think that many libertarians disagree about this issue because they think that there's an underlying empirical question, right? We have debate for as long as people have thought to think and talk about these things about the humanness and personness and ensouledness and 14 other categories that may or may not apply to a fetus. So first of all, I think, you know, to say, well, it's just a question of rights or not rights is not quite correct, since it's also a question of what is actually going on in that entity, which is something about which reasonable people disagree. The other thing I would say is, as you
but
know, I'm not a big fan.
There can only be one answer, right? There can only be one answer. So it's one of those things where it's like,
well,
you either have the right or you don't.
But we often say in cases where answers of fact are difficult that we err on the side of not regulating or legislating, right? This is a routinely a libertarian answer. And that's one of the many reasons that I broadly do not support bills like the Georgia bill or really any additional restrictions on abortion. I think, though, that the other question is the question of secondary consequences. And I think one reason that this Georgia bill has caused so much controversy is because it's so easy for people, even people who don't typically think a lot about unintended consequences, to see the ways in which enforcement might go very wrong. And this gets us into the question of opposing prohibition, right? And I see this, and particularly this formulation of an abortion bill, as a prohibition. The fact that the women themselves will not be treated as criminals, but the providers of the abortions will, as far as anyone can tell from reading the law, which is, again, not written to be clear about that question, but instead written to generate the maximally useful Supreme Court challenge. The fact that that difference is already being split, and that further the change in technology since Roe v. Wade, which includes being able to mail someone from any state a pill that is very effective and safe in causing an abortion, means that sometimes you don't need a third party to have a medical abortion. And what does that mean for implementing the law? And the answer broadly is going to be massive incursions on women's civil liberties. And that, I think, is worth debating over and above the baseline question of, well, is there a right or is there not a right? There's just a bunch of other interesting stuff going on here that's really important to talk about.
And there's a related to the kind of the pill question, there is now an interesting debate about whether or not a prohibition would in fact be dangerous to women. Because right, sort of the old argument used to be, okay, it's going to go, they're going to go back to back alley coat hanger abortions, which are incredibly dangerous. And now black market abortion looks like a pretty safe pill that you can take at home and is really.
And of course, there will still be people for whom it goes wrong. And there also will be people for whom a miscarriage goes wrong and they're scared to seek health treatment.
Much less of an issue. And so
right.
Which side does that?
It's like if we're doing a calculus of
like which side does that help?
If you're doing a calculus of whose side got stronger, I think it's like very telling and a very reasoned question to investigate. Like, technology changed the way the law works again. And of course, also there's the underlying question of, well, technology that keeps babies that are born very, very early alive is rapidly changing as well. That cutoff of 24 weeks, 23 weeks, 22 weeks, 21 weeks keeps slipping backward. And given that the rationale of the court was based at least in part on viability, it has to be revisited.
Yep.
And technology also affected the culture around this topic too, I think, because the widespread use of ultrasounds and being able to sort of visualize, hey, look, that's a thing in the body. That's more than a thing. That's
and
a,
actually,
it's a human.
Even right, the heartbeat bill itself, it's about a technology that makes it possible to detect that heartbeat, which is not even a heart yet. Like, that's actually an interesting point. Is it's a tube that will be a heart that's vibrating.
Can we agree from a broad libertarian perspective? And again, you know,
almost
people
certainly
disagree
no
on this.
Is the answer to your question. Go ahead.
No,
sorry.
No, but the idea that a law is going to dictate specific things. So in some of these bills, it's that a pregnant woman who is seeking an abortion has to look at an ultrasound or specifically deny this, that the default, that the legislature will start dictating medical procedures en masse. Generally speaking, there needs to be a really high bar for that kind of stuff, right? Where the state, right, a legislature is going to reach in. And you see again and again in this debate, there's a ton of stuff like that where it's always, the pro-life forces routinely try to dictate very specific practices that in almost any other area, people, you know, conservative people who tend to be pro-life would be like, you've got to get the state out of this, like get out of my life, you know, get off my land and things like that. I mean, I think it's worth looking at that this is not kind of like a neutral thing and it's not a moderate or compromising thing. This is a specific strategy to reach a very particular goal, which is that there should be no abortions.
And that goal, I think, is not one that is shared by the rest of the country. I will leave this topic with the following extended metaphor. So strap in. But I think was it Sanford and Son, Nick, where Red Fox, let me at him as soon as there was somebody in between the person that he would actually fight. This is like a baseball fight or something, right? When the players don't actually want to fight each other, but when there's an umpire, when there's a coach in between them, then they get all aggressive. I would have, right, if you'd have just let me at him. I feel like a lot of the abortion debate over time and certain other debates in politics have been kind of like that. I've been trying to fight against this forever, but they won't let me, this person in the middle. And then it's kind of useful for both sides to fundraise off that. My impression is right now, and the middle in that case is Nick's kind of consensus. It's the 20 to 22 weeks, and let's argue over the kind of local variance over that. But changing that from 20 to 22 to 6, on one hand, and then on the other hand, the arguments over super late term abortion feels like suddenly people decided to throw the umpire aside and let's actually fight. And I think people are going to be in for a rude surprise when they suddenly go from such a a kind of a rough standoff into I'm going to change the terms of the debate so radically and get to a place where Americans don't want to be.
I gotta say, Matt, you did really pretty well on that metaphor, except the part at the very beginning where you urged us to strap in for the abortion metaphor.
I hope the headline on this episode is why the abortion debate is like Sanford and Sons.
Nope, it will not be.
That's a good idea. Let's segue into our latest constitutional crisis. Just a hard segue. Not even try to paper it over. This escaped my attention last week when it happened. I finally have plugged my ears so thoroughly with my middle fingers about Trump-Russia stuff that I didn't really notice that the House Judiciary Chair, Jerry Nadler, declared that the nation is in a constitutional crisis out there because the Trump administration is encouraging the use of executive privilege to discourage former White House counsel Don McGahn from testifying. And I think Donald Trump Jr. doesn't want to testify and respond to subpoenas. They're also Attorney General Bill Barr is refusing directives from the House Judiciary Committee to release the entirety of the Mueller report unredacted to the entirety of Congress. And so this equals a constitutional crisis. It wasn't just a stray comment. It was also picked up by Peter Suderman's favorite Democrat, Nancy Pelosi, the next day, saying, in fact, we are in a constitutional crisis here. We've been skeptical about that term in the past. And I don't want my own personal skepticism to override possible reexamination of things under the facts. So, Peter, I'll start with you. Did we get to the constitutional crisis while I was napping?
It happened this morning. It's actually if you check the constitutional crisis meter on isthereaconstitutionalcrisis.net.
It's red now.
It just tipped over.
Cool.
I would say that we are in something of a constitutional conflict, but it is actually reasonably common for the White House to resist subpoenas from congressional investigators. Now, are they exactly supposed to in most circumstances? Not really. But this is the sort of thing that we have dealt with before. It happens. I would say that we may be heading towards an even stronger and fiercer form of constitutional conflict between the branches. But the House is doing what the House is supposed to do, is allowed to do, which is investigate the executive branch and perform oversight. And the executive branch is doing what modern executive branches in particular do, which is saying, well, we don't really like the opposing party doing that. And so we are going to do everything we can not to play ball. But they haven't resisted a court order, strong legal decision by a court yet. We have not gotten to the point where the president is just saying, well, the Supreme Court can go, screw themselves. We have not gotten to the point where the president is, ordering martial law or, basically just saying that I absolutely refuse to follow anything that Congress says. The president has, in some cases, arguably not followed the law strictly to the letter, but certainly so did Obama. I mean, certainly with Obamacare, there were a number of instances in which the executive branch simply did not follow the letter of the law. They chose to do what they wanted to do policy-wise. For example, on making payments to insurers that a court ruled were not allowed by Congress, had not been authorized, and Congress has the power of the purse. And so, If we're in a constitutional crisis right now,
then we've been in one for
many years and probably for decades. The conflict here is real, and I don't want to say that it's nothing and that it couldn't lead to some fairly intense outcomes. In particular, I still think it's reasonably. I don't know if I would say it's likely, but it's certainly possible that the House will move towards impeachment. But that's part of what's going on is that the Trump administration, and this is actually, I think, the funniest thing, the Trump administration is trying to bait the House Democrats into impeaching Donald Trump because Donald Trump believes that would be good for him politically.
And he might not be wrong.
He might be
and
right.
And I think he is
totally right.
No, he's so. And so if you think about going into, like, coming out of last year's midterm election, Nancy Pelosi was like, we're not going to focus on impeachment. We're going to focus on policy, healthcare, jobs, the economy, all the stuff that we won the election on. All like these kitchen table issues. That's what 2020 is going to be about. Impeachment, you know, we're going to wait for the Mueller report to come in. We'll take a look. But like, that's not going to be our focus, because she understood that that's not what wins elections. And if the and
this
if House Democrats
more of the Suderman Pelosi fan club.
But, no,
in
but here
action.
Is the thing is that Donald Trump is basically buying Nancy Pelosi's logic that if they focus on policy, they will win. And if they focus on Russia and impeachment and like resisting subpoenas, they will lose. And so he is trying to bait them into impeaching him because he thinks that the way to get elected president is to be impeached.
Donald Trump's top political strategist is now Nancy Pelosi.
But Trump has actually done a lot of policy changes. You know, when you think of it, and not all good, some good. You know, the tax bill taken apart from the revenue problems with it is not a bad thing, generally. You know, his trade policy
those
is terrible,
revenue problems
et cetera,
are pretty significant.
No, of course. But what I'm saying is, like, Trump actually is advancing a policy agenda that's pretty strong and robust and is better than, you know, or it's active, it's muscular.
And is he running on it, and is it popular?
Yeah. Well, actually, he is. He's saying, like, look at the unemployment rate, look at the economy, look at all of the things that I've done to make America great again.
So the tax bill in particular.
The tax bill did not factor into
Republicans, you know,
Is he running on? He is pointing to the unemployment rate among minorities, among women, among, you know, whites, among everything. Like, he's pointing to the economy and saying, I am responsible for this.
Yes,
and
I think he has a series of policies. I think he's taking credit for the economy.
Yeah. No, and that doesn't mark him as different, but he has a good economy. But he's saying that he has made
the economy awesome by waging a ridiculous trade war.
Wait, this is a separate issue. This is a separate issue. The question is, the constitutional crisis that has been proclaimed or pronounced by Gerald Nadler is bullshit. It's politics as usual, to the extent that we've had a constitutional crisis. This has been going on for all of the 21st century and like the second half of the 20th century. And it's political battles between Congress and the presidency. Some of it's serious, much of it is serious, but we should not be taking it seriously. The idea that we're in a particular constitutional crisis, nothing has happened in the past 2 years, much less, you know, in the last 2 weeks that would come close to that. And it's worth understanding, you know, kind of like our political discussions now are purely political. Like, they have nothing to do with principle and they have virtually nothing to do with policy for the most part.
I do think, though, that this is also like, when I hear them say the phrase constitutional crisis, I want to be like, this thing is the one that finally made you say that? Like, what about all the wars that we are currently fighting without proper authorization? What about, like, you know, I think that there is a bad habit forming in our Twitter discourse lately of, like, you can't talk about thing X when thing Y is the really important thing, because, of course, people talk about all kinds of things all the time. But in this particular case, I do feel like I would keep my constitutional crisis powder dry for several ongoing, legitimate, major issues with noncompliance to very clear constitutional directives about the behavior of the three branches of government.
You can't have sex with a woman when there's a heartbeat bill in Georgia.
Yes.
Right? It's actually kind of.
Yeah. It's like you
on
you
the
can.
Same spectrum.
So, yeah, I guess that my never go full libertarian. But my go full libertarian today is like, how can we even be talking about this when there are real constitutional crises all around us? The end.
And also there, I mean, the very specific underlying behaviors here are. The administration is invoking executive privilege to try to get a former administration official not to testify, which Barack Obama did and which George W. Bush, they both did that. Eric Holder, the attorney general, the previous attorney general, also did not comply with Congress saying, please give me all these documents and informations about X, which in this case was Fast and Furious. He was impeached. He was censured for contempt of Congress with 67 Democrats voting for that, incidentally. And the language used to describe these incidents that happened in the George W. Bush case, it was Harriet Myers, I think, that they didn't have testify. people did not routinely, whether they were journalists or whether they were senior, politicians, did not routinely call this a constitutional crisis. I think what people's default setting is such a level of hysteria that they are draining actual basic meaning out of the language. And I think if you were really, really, really concerned about norms, being thrown out the window and all this kind of stuff, maybe you would hold on to language so that it carried some potency for the day when the bad thing happens. And I don't think the bad thing has happened yet.
It's really very much like a baseball fight.
And it's
a lot like a baseball fight.
And it is Trump's genius is that he forces people to be idiots. I mean, he really has deranged people. And so, like, you have serious Democratic presidential candidates talking about running on getting rid of the Electoral College or packing the Supreme Court and things like that, because Trump is, we can't normalize Trump. So we're going to blow up a bunch of centuries old institutions. And it's like, come on. Like, and we don't, we don't all have to participate in other people's Trump derangement syndrome. There's plenty of real stuff going on that we should be discussing.
Speaking of real derangements, the next president of the United States, Bernie Sanders, today tweeted out, and I won't do this in Bernie voice as much as I'm in.
Come on,
tempted
to. Do it in full Bernie voice.
Look. So he says, in the Divine Comedy, Dante reserved a special place in the seventh circle of hell for people who charge usurious interest rates. Today, we don't need the hellfire, but we do need a national usury law that caps interest rates on credit cards and consumer loans at 15%. And before I ask Peter to talk about why that's wrong, Nick, you're a doctor of literature. Is this the correct invocation of Dante?
It is actually Circle 7, yeah. I made sure that was good. The first thing I did.
Fact-checked.
I Googled to make sure that
It's the seventh circle.
Yeah. Okay, Suderman, you wrote, and I quote the headline, Bernie Sanders' new plan will make it tougher for poor people to get credit cards. Why are you in the pocket of big payday loan, Peter?
When Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez announced this plan last week, Bernie Sanders tweeted out, it's great that in Vermont, we don't have payday loans at all. Whereas in Texas, they do. And the rates are just totally outrageous. And so we've just basically completely eliminated them by capping payday loan rates so low that the business doesn't exist. If you look at the literature and in particular at some of the personal reporting on how payday loans and check cashing services are used, they turn out to be quite useful and valuable financial instruments, in particular for people of limited means, for people who live paycheck to paycheck. They allow for income smoothing. They are a much better and in some cases actually cheaper alternative to what they would be doing otherwise. In particular, a lot of people who end up taking out payday loans have had bad experiences with banks and with overdraft fees. Because these people live paycheck to paycheck, because they have, because their bank accounts are not packed. They did not, for example, make $880,000 last year off of a best-selling book like Bernie Sanders did. Because those people don't have those kinds of means, they're often living on very small kind of margins. And so they end up with overdraft fees. Banks often structure overdrafts to kind of maximize the number of penalties and fees that you incur, depending on how those checks or debits are, the timing of them and the size. And so people basically, a lot of these folks are like, well, I don't want to use a traditional bank or I don't want to use it primarily. Instead, I'm going to use these payday loan services. I'm going to use check cashing services. They find that they are much clearer in terms of the terms. They find that they are that they're friendly and useful. So there was part of my post was looking at an interview with a woman who was in many ways a kind of typical liberal who had thought, well, look, I don't understand why people would use these things. Aren't they being exploited? Don't they know that? And she went and she actually worked at one of these services for a couple of months. And what she found was that these people knew exactly what they were doing. They actually really liked these services. They were very smart and very savvy about their finances. And so to a large extent, there is, this is Bernie Sanders being condescending, thinking that basically that poor people don't know how to manage their money and don't know what services are good for them and what sorts of services will provide, they need. And so when he brags about banning payday lenders in Vermont, he's bragging about eliminating useful services for people who don't have a lot of money. And what he wants to do with in terms of credit cards is basically the exact same thing. He wants to cap rates much lower than they are, even median rates. Median rates are a little over 20%. He wants to have a cap at 15%. People who have worse credit scores, which is to say typically people who have less money or sort of more who do not have a kind of consistent finances and big backstops, they tend to pay rates that are more like 25%. And so what would that do? That means that credit card issuers, to the extent that they could operate, they would focus on giving credit to people who were good credit risks. That is to say, people who are upper middle class, people who have a lot of money, people who repay, and not people who are more difficult credit risks. And so Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez are out to make life worse for people who already have difficult and trying financial circumstances. That's what this would do. And it's wrong and it's offensive.
Those people will still...
I think it's a good shorthand that whenever legislators start getting into, super specific things, saying like, no credit card interest rates above 15% anywhere. I'm the boss. Like, that's a big problem. It's the same thing with the abortion debate. Like, when you have national legislators or state legislators starting to dictate very specific terms in any particular industry or whatever, something has gone wrong and it's only going to get worse and worse. And it inevitably screws over the people that they're trying to help.
And to be clear, this does not mean that poor people won't take out loans. They will still get loans. They will just get loans on much worse terms with minimal legal recourse for both parties when something goes wrong.
So one of the findings that I noted in my piece is that in states that have capped payday loan interest rates, which basically means states that don't have payday loan industries, because the caps are typically much lower than payday loans sort of end up having on an annualized basis. In those states, you have... market noticeably more pawn shop licenses. Why do we think that is? Because people go to an alternative service,
right.
And so this is the
they
idea.
Also
like,
those places all have more overdraft
right.
fees.
And
same
this
deal.
is the thing. I think that Bernie Sanders, that Ocasio-Cortez, that in fact nearly all politicians just don't understand is that sure we would. I think all of us would agree that like traditional banking and checking accounts are probably a better option for most people. Probably for the majority, certainly for a lot of people. But that doesn't make them the best option for everyone. And it is wrong for politicians to go in and say, well, we're going to eliminate a second best option for people and in hopes that, well, then everybody will have lives, we'll have these kind of consistent, perfect upper middle class lives. That's not how it works. In fact, they end up making people's lives worse off.
I want to note that I went looking for a specific fact from the Reason website. And so I Googled my name and the word usury and came up with an article by me from 2007, literally titled Three Cheers for Usury. That's just about it's tied to
future editor in chief of Reason.com.
Exactly.
Folks. Reason
it's,
magazine.
It's tied to an academic paper that came out around that time that has this great little zinger in it. Charge 80% per year on a loan in the U.S. and you're called a usurer, charge 80% on a loan in Latin America or Africa, and you too can be a poverty alleviation charity. And this is, of course, the most extreme example of exactly what Peter is describing, which is like if you give some lady in Kenya the money to buy a cow and give it to her at what would be a very, very high rate in the American credit market, you have done good. That is a good thing. We broadly agreed, particularly in this moment of microcredit in the mid aughts, that this was like a a really powerful tool for bettering people's lives. It is still true. And the fact that...
makes you a purveyor of global economic justice.
Yes, you are a purveyor of global economic justice. But if you do exactly the same thing on exactly the same terms in the United States, you are literally deserve to be consigned to hell, according to Bernie Sanders.
Sanders also, in the clip that's been making the rounds, he talks about the loan shark hoodlums in their three-piece suits. He's dangerously trapped in a kind of like, you know, a Bowery Boys world or something like that, where, you know, there's like vague intimations of kind of old anti-Semitic stereotypes in a lot of what he talks about. But it's like he's living in a black and white world. All of his memories are from the Great Depression. And it's like, you know, you have to go to a 24-hour dance marathon in order to, and if you don't win, then you'll just die from exhaustion, as opposed to winning $5 and then eating steak and potatoes with hot coffee or something. I mean, there is something deliriously wrong about the way he views the contemporary world. And it's not simply that he, you know, went to the Soviet Union on his honeymoon or anything like that. He does not understand how the fucking world works. And for that reason, he should not really be taken seriously as a politician.
The other funny part of this bill is that the solution that Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders have proposed to the, well, you know, poor people wouldn't be able to get credit. They say, no, we'll allow them to, we will allow post offices to be turned into banks. The post office lost $4 billion last year and is on track to lose $7 billion this year. So they would be pushing people into a financial relationship with an institution that cannot, that is unsustainable, and cannot balance its books. It's an absolutely awful idea.
I do want to know, by the way, I found the article I was originally looking for, which Matt Welsh put the title "Payday of Reckoning" on. Just live with yourself about that.
I think I just got that headline. 2009. Gave me cancer.
The great headline switch happened in like 2010, 2011, when all lousy Gen X puns went out the window.
Payday of reckoning. But I do want to note the factoid I was looking for is that in 1787, there was like a major Enlightenment guy's fight between Jeremy Bentham, who was a defender of usury, and he went after the... then aging Adam Smith for his support on legal limits on the rate of interest. So you could probably do a whole like even Adam Smith supported caps on payday lending thing here.
I just want to point out, Catherine, that when I was editor in chief, as you rightly point out, of the magazine, you were like the go-to. Okay, who's going to be the libertarian a-hole to say that plastic bags are good for you and usury is great?
I don't know why you're saying that in the past tense, my man.
That's also very true. And like all of the things that you defended, with the possible exception of not voting, are now like the law of the land in the other direction.
Oh yeah,
in every blue state.
I am tired of losing. I am not tired of winning.
You are losing all day long. Kind of question or observation. I'll kind of throw this to you, Peter, since you're our Johnny on the Liz Warren beat. It strikes me, and here is where I say, Stephanie Slade, go into the other room and make yourself some coffee.
She doesn't drink coffee.
That's the problem, one of many.
There are no problems with Stephanie Slade.
Cautiously sip a five-hour energy, then.
No problems with Stephanie Slade, folks.
No. But there's problems with how she's going to get mad at me. But
are you Matt? Are you going to say that the interest rate on abortion loans should be uncapped?
Jesus.
Early stage polling on interest rates on abortion loans shows that Stephanie Slade just killed herself.
All the people who are competing in the Democratic 2020 primary and issuing one elaborate, super leftoid economic regulation style policy after another, all of them are underperforming or trending downward, with the only exception lately, and it's a minor one, of Elizabeth Warren. Meanwhile, you know, Grandpa Joe Biden is just gobbling 40% of in just about every poll. There was a piece, I think, today by Jonathan Chait, saying, hey, maybe we overestimated the whole democratic socialism thing there, and people who obviously have no actual ideological conviction other than using government power, like Kamala Harris, are reportedly rethinking some of their super progressivism, Johnny Come Lately progressivism. Is there a lesson out there, Suderman, do you think, or is it premature and Stephanie Slade Wright to be mad at me?
I think that there's a little bit of a, there's less of a lesson. It's just not clear still, right? So the main thing that we have learned is that Democrats are not wildly in favor of the Bernie Sanders agenda, right? That's not the sort of the beating heart of the party. It might be the most vocal part on Twitter. It might be in some ways the loudest part in Congress. It might be the loudest part even sort of in a kind of Democratic media. But that's not definitely where the Democratic Party is. On the other hand, it's May. It is May of the year before the election. We have not had a debate yet, and the debates are starting early this year. If you go back to 2015, Republican primary debates started in August. We are going to start having Democratic debates in June of this year. We still haven't gotten there yet, and so most people, Democrats, Republicans, Libertarians, me, are still just like not focusing on this as much as they will. Early next year, in through the next, you know, next summer, when some of these issues, when this really becomes something. I mean, nobody's going to vote until for 7-8 more months.
It's not clear what Biden stands for at this point.
Right. I mean, Biden is literally I stand for, you know, some stuff. It's some Democratic stuff. I'm a union man. I don't know about that Medicare for all. Let's just expand Medicare down, make it a little bigger in some other ways. But let's talk about that later. Mostly right now, let's talk about me and how I'm going to beat Donald Trump. And in fact, if you look at the polls, what are Democrats say the most important thing is? Somebody who can beat Trump.
The stuff that is troubling, I think, is, you know, one, we've talked about this quite a bit, but, you know, according to Gallup, a large majority of Democrats, about 60% almost, want a more moderate party. So that's good. But it's also true, most people, a majority of people want the government to be doing more than it is now. So, you know, where this ends up, because Trump is also muscular. Trump is, you know, trying to dictate what businesses do, et cetera. You know, I think from a pure libertarian perspective, the real question is how much is the ratchet going up towards a more interventionist government in almost all aspects of our lives?
And
there
I
are
would
some
also
deregulatory moves yeah. by Trump, but his heart is in bossing people around. It's not in leaving them alone. And that should be troubling. And then you have the Democrats who are like even more to the left of him on that.
And even if Elizabeth Warren doesn't win, which I expect she will not win, I would not bet on her winning. She is influencing the Democratic policy agenda, and she is shaping that agenda, setting it in many ways for years to come, unless there is some sort of historic defeat where they really just go and think, man, that was a terrible idea. A guy like Joe Biden, if he becomes president, is going to look at the Elizabeth Warren policy agenda and maybe not adopt it wholesale, but is going to be using that as a playbook in a lot of ways. And so even if she is not being successful politically and electorally, she is doing stuff that is certainly from a libertarian perspective quite worrying, and is going to change policy, I suspect, over the next decade.
Let's find out what our contestants have been consuming in the cultural arena. I will start with myself because I can. I obviously, like all real Americans, spent the weekend watching the most thrilling conference semifinals in the history of the National Basketball Association. Incredible Game 7 is all great, but I won't bore Catherine and Peter even more, and instead say that for the first time in my life, I watched the Disney movie Hunchback of Notre Dame, or Notre Dame, as they say, my in-laws.
This is the Tom Hulce one with Jason Alexander?
Yes.
Yep. And Demi Moore.
Yes, which I somehow had never seen it before, mm-hmm. and it's both pretty great, like it's visually beautiful, the depictions of the church, and just like that's dark AF. That is like the seriously darkest thing. And I want to shout out to the internet because Frollo, who's the bad guy, at some point in the middle of a pretty terrifyingly awful and dark and sexualized kind of thing with Esmeralda, does a really good hair sniff. And I'm like, okay, bring me the Joe Biden, bring me the Joe Biden internet. And I went on and there was Joe Biden being Frollo sniffing Esmeralda's hair. And that makes me very happy. Which one of you nerds is going to talk about Game of Thrones?
I am happy to point out that the highlight of last night's episode.
I just got so excited I dropped my laptop.
The highlight of last night's episode, Matt, and in a way that you'll understand, is that we learned that Cersei and Jaime are the greatest brother sister combo in American culture since Richard and Karen Carpenter.
Oh wow! Okay, so someone's playing drums, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, you could call it that.
How long have you been prepping that line, Nick?
About 30 seconds.
Wow. Yeah. I'm impressed.
The other thing,
Bill Blaise Jousky.
Game of Thrones was good, and I'm genuinely interested to see how it plays out in the final analysis. And I'm hoping that the obvious thing where Daenerys has been driven mad with power and needs to have a reckoning, I hope there's some twist on that, because otherwise it's too predictable. But what I was going to say is that the thing that I consumed and caught up on, which was kind of lost in the shadow cast by Game of Thrones, was Veep. The series ends this year, and it's tremendous. It caps a multi-year run. Veep is absolutely the best political commentary show I can remember in my lifetime. It is so nasty and mean and revelatory and funny. It's just really fantastic, and I would highly recommend that people who like comedy and dislike politics check it out if they haven't already.
There's a great little feature in New York Magazine up today about how they iterate the jokes and insults from the initial write drafts through the filming process. And so they like take a little sequence and show you all of the iterations that it went through before it actually gets filmed, and it's pretty fascinating.
Peter, what have you been?
I watched Game of Thrones too, but what I actually want to talk about is a short little book by my friend Michael Brendan Doherty, a writer at National Review. I've known Michael for a very long time, so everyone should take this with many grains of salt as a friend endorsement. I am obviously not a neutral party here, but his first book is out, I believe, this week. It's called My Father Left Me Ireland. It is a memoir slash kind of quasi defense of nostalgic nationalism. It's just really elegant and wonderfully written. And he's wrong about a lot of stuff. He's really a kind of a committed localist, place-based nationalist type. Writes a lot about kind of finding his identity in the Easter Rising, in Ireland, and sort of in the history of the place. But he's such a great writer. He's so interesting, and it's also, you know, for a book like this, it is not an argument so much as a depiction. It's not right. It's not like a book length kind of policy paper op-ed type thing. It's really a kind of personal and deftly written piece about his individual feelings. And while he sort of rejects the idea at the end of we just get to choose our identities, it's also like a book about how one individual chose and constructed an identity out of a culture and a nation and a history. And it's fascinating in that respect. And so just in terms of, I mean, I enjoyed it because Michael Brendan Doherty is a good friend of mine, but also because it's a really well-written book. And so, I would recommend it because it's my friend's book, but also because it's really well-written and really, really enjoyable to read.
If I could just add on to that, and I speak as I've read the book, and I speak as somebody who's Irish American, the performative contradiction that Peter was alluding to in the book of it's a rejection of kind of self-invented culture or identity, cultural identity, is strong, and it's worth reading for that. And it's what I left with, Peter, was, and I don't know Michael particularly well, but it's more what This is a whole that is made out of a broken culture and out of a loss, you know, starting with his father, you know, refusing to really be part of his life, his Irish father. The question is, what, how does this play out in his kid's life? Because the problem with Irishness is that it's a tragic, backward looking culture that makes its people somehow unfit for the contemporary world, much less the future. So it's a very interesting book to read, even as I, like you, disagree with many of his large claims.
That was a pretty dark turn there at the end of Irishness, Nick.
It always is.
I mean, what do you mean? It's like, Matt, I hear Van Morrison playing in the background. It's always 3 o'clock.
As long as you don't have that damn tin flute.
Yeah.
It's all the good. Catherine, what have you been?
What tin flute?
And all the cocaine that Mitch McConnell can snort. Catherine, what have you been doing?
I mean, falling asleep during that bit. So I have one very fast recommendation for a magazine article, which is the Atlantic's June issue has a piece called Was Shakespeare a Woman? My answer to you, my friends, is definitely not based on this article. This is a classic example of the question headline where the answer is always no. But more importantly, the article is the logical consequence of believing that people can only write themselves. The reason that this person investigates this question of is Shakespeare a woman is because Shakespeare wrote good women. And it's like a very interesting flip side of like, well, if our official position vis-a-vis cultural appropriation is you can only write what you are, and this person did a really good job of writing women, we are forced to consider the question that they might be a woman. That is the interesting backwards world that we now live in. It's really worth a read. On the other side, though, I want to give you a Ron Bailey recommendation, which is a book called The Power. He reviews it as a bit woke, but leavened by some canny insights into male privilege. And before you die from that recommendation, it's speculative fiction about what would happen if women could casually electrocute men, with the idea being to investigate how much of, quote unquote, the patriarchy and male privilege stems from the physical differences between men and women. If women could routinely overpower men, what would the world look like?
Electrocute?
Yeah.
So what would happen besides a lot of electrocuted men?
I'm sensing a sex strike, probably.
Yeah, you don't need a sex strike if you can electrocute the men, dude. Yeah, so I mean, it's, you know, it basically just, it explores the idea of what if men were always just a teeny bit afraid women would kill them, which, at least according to some feminist tropes, is more or less the state of women in the real world right now. And it's very fascinating.
Would you have to be in sight of the man to
electrocute them? You have to touch them.
Okay.
You have to be,
it's not like them. Just think of a man and that person is electrocuted.
No, but you may be missing the point here,
Drake,
which is not the technical details of the electrocution.
I want to know how these powers
work. Radiation. Gamma radiation
gamma
is the
rays.
Answer.
What is the origin story? What is the
origin story is actually good. It's like a bit sort of mysterious, but basically all of the sudden, a bunch of 15-year-old girls acquire this power, and then it spreads outward from there. And it's a good, like, also, you know, puberty is terrifying, and what if? So anyway, I recommend it because Ron Bailey recommends it. And if that's not the biggest case for male privilege, I don't know what is.
I'll just put a cap on it by saying if we are believing that writing women characters is a sign of a possible womanliness, we can state for certain that J.R.R. Tolkien is not a woman.
Yeah, for sure. We can feel confident there.
Thank you for listening, everybody. And wait for us next Monday. And also listen to the recent podcast throughout the week as lots of good things happen, including a lot of terrific Nick Gillespie interviews. Thanks. Goodbye.